You're listening to Atheistically Speaking.
Hey everyone, welcome to Atheistically Speaking. I'm Thomas.
And I'm David.
We've decided for this episode that after going back and forth about it, we're just going to read the whole of the articles. They're not terribly long. And we figure if you're listening in your car or exercising or something, it's going to be tough for you to pull them up online and read along. And it's also going to be kind of tough for us to summarize them in an efficient way. So we're going to try this, and we'll have to get some feedback from you guys and see if you don't like it, then we can change. If you do like it, then that's how we'll do this. So having said that, why don't you go ahead and start us off, David?
Sure. So this is Leaving the Tribe, Why I'm No Longer Part of the Online Atheism Community. This is written by Martin Pribble, and it can be found on Slate. So this reads... For the last 5 years, I have considered myself an activist atheist. I trolled Facebook and Twitter for theists and told them why they are wrong. I made fun of them for their irresponsible or unreasonable beliefs. I would analyze and nitpick their statements, show examples of just where they went wrong and why, and even at times ridicule them when they seemed to be no option left, all in the vain hope that I might be able to sway them to a more rational way of viewing the world and the universe. This could be extremely satisfying, and sometimes I find I could even come to a level of agreement with a believer about the realities of life. I even have friends among my Twitter following who are priests and strong Christians.
Okay, so that first paragraph, what strikes me now is I didn't realize the header title was actually Leaving the Tribe. I don't. When you pull it up, my tab says just why I'm quitting the online atheism community, but Leaving the Tribe is actually the header title, like the bigger title. And the things he's describing here, I just find it funny that I don't partake in any of these activities. So I guess I'm not part of whatever tribe this is. I guess that'd be my first observation here.
Yeah, right. And he's already describing the activist atheist as someone who does these sorts of things, which I think is maybe a little bit of a narrow interpretation.
Could be. Yeah. I think that it's kind of showing that he's looking at things kind of through his experiences, every experience of atheists, don't you think?
Right.
A little bit, but we'll go on.
Sure. So he continues, but I'm through with it, and I no longer want to be a part of the online atheist community. What I was once a proud member of, a group who fought against the evils of deliberate misinformation coming from religious groups and people, has become, at least on the surface, a parade of contradiction and caterwauling against theists who have no clue that there could be an alternative viewpoint or understanding of the universe than their own. The times of satisfaction are outweighed by feelings of frustration and hopelessness. Don't get me wrong, I'm still an atheist, but I will no longer be dragged into debates with these theists who make a ludicrous claim, then base their evidence on the very book from which their ludicrous claims originate. There is no point in it. All this back and forth sniping serves to do is to make us feel a sense of superiority to the person making the claims, and does nothing for them except leave them with a smugness about their assumption that atheists are all mean. Faith overrides knowledge and truth in any situation, so arguing with a theist is akin to banging your head against a brick wall. You will injure yourself and achieve little.
Mm.
I think that last bit, that's kind of the meat of the article, I think. Or at least the start of it. You will injure yourself and achieve little. It kind of goes along with how he is describing the active atheist in the first bit that we went through.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's true. I don't know. I mean, I guess I'll just say, what's your experience with this? Because honestly, this is not, I can imagine this and I'm not trying to look through things just through my lens and apply it to the whole atheist quote unquote community. But I don't really do this. I mean, I do follow, I have people I follow on Twitter, different atheist podcasters and stuff that I've come into contact with. And there are some of them who, Twitter mine, kind of go and look and find religious people. I honestly don't even know how they search for that, but they find religious posts and then they kind of, you know, tweet their replies to them. I don't really do that. I don't know if, I don't know. Do you ever do anything like that? Is that part of your?
No, I haven't done anything like that. What I have, I mean, I have engaged with religious people, in the past much more regularly than I do now. And it's debating.
Do you mean more personally or online?
You personally, yeah. Okay. I haven't done the online part of it.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify.
Yeah, but he does. I guess I don't see the difference between the personal and the online bit.
I think the difference is that if it's in person, that kind of implies that it's someone you maybe have a relationship with. I mean, there aren't that many ways to go. I don't think there are all that many people who are parading around like door-to-door atheists, you know? So it kind of implies like it could be more, I guess it could be more honest in a way. Like it's not, okay, I'm going to go Google or search Twitter or Facebook for like dumb theists. You know, I'm going to search some keywords that's going to show me, you know, who the dumbest believers are, and I'm going to spam them with my comment. You know, like if it's in person, it's kind of more like, okay, this is a friend of mine who maybe the topic comes up or maybe I bring it up. You know what I mean? Don't you think?
Maybe. That kind of made me think, I wonder if it has to do with who you choose to engage.
Yeah.
If you're engaging initially with, you know, maybe it's in a forum that has, like, maybe it's Twitter, and you're tweeting back at somebody and other people can join in the fray, tweeting at you and at the original poster. You can ignore, or maybe you should ignore, the people, religious or not, who are just kind of doing this, banging your head against a brick wall, or the name calling, or that sort of thing. Just by not engaging them, you avoid that. I mean, is it really that difficult to engage with people who can, like, hold a conversation and not get nasty about it online?
Yeah,
maybe it's a little bit more
know.
Difficult, but it's not. It's certainly not impossible, I don't think.
Yeah, I guess it does. You're right. It does totally depend. I mean, if you're on Reddit, or if you're on like a forum comments for a particular article or website, you're definitely going to get a different selection depending on where you go. And you're right. You can kind of pick. I don't know. It sounds like he's talking about people who are probably quite a bit dogmatic and fundamentalist, I'd say. It sounds to me like the way he's describing the conversations.
Yeah.
So I personally I have no experience with that, because honestly, you can't really talk to those people. I mean, you can try. I am never of the, I guess I'll say this because it is, I'll say this now because it does kind of go off the last sentence we just read, which was, you will injure yourself and achieve little. That for me never really holds much water as an argument. I mean, if I'm taking the time to argue with someone, that's because I'm making a decision to do it and I enjoy it. You know, I never think of that as like, oh, I'm banging my head against the wall. You know, like if someone has interested me enough to where I'm trying to argue with them, then that means I'm getting something out of it. Otherwise, what, you know, I don't think of that as injuring myself, you know, like,
yeah, you're describing in kind of a roundabout way, a pretty popular way of describing the use of philosophy or why you should present arguments. And fundamentally it's best case scenario, you're right, the other person's wrong, and you convince them. Okay. That's great. Mm-hmm. Worst case scenario is you're right, they're wrong. Well, maybe you're wrong.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
And they're right, and then you get convinced if you allow yourself to be, if you're open to that.
Right.
And that's wonderful, right?
Yeah.
But even if you're right and they're wrong and you cannot convince them, you at least, I think practice might not be the right way to describe it, but you get some exposure to discussing the concept,
yeah,
within their, you know, framework of how they see the world. Or it's quite possible that you're both wrong, and by discussing it with somebody else or having an argument with somebody else, you realize that, you know, you still think they're wrong, but you come to believe that you are also wrong as well.
Right, and that can especially happen in a forum, like you mentioned before, where other people jump in too.
Yeah.
I've had that happen on Facebook before, back when back when anything happened on Facebook. Now I, now it's just pictures of food and kids. So I don't, there's not a lot of, there used to be a time when people would post opinions. Maybe it's just my particular friend circle or because I'm getting older, you know, as it's gone, you know, as we've aged up here, none of my friends talk about anything interesting anymore. Maybe they've blocked me. They've all blocked me.
Yeah, you've been blocked.
No, I was never like that big of a bully or whatever, but I you know, and also it could be that it's been a year or two since the election. That's usually the time when things,
yeah, that's true.
Election time is when it all comes up again. So yeah, right, I guess we'll continue.
Yeah. So I'll continue on. He says, "This will not change an awful lot of what I do online, but I think I've come to a point where I'm only injuring myself if I were to continue engaging in theistic debating about things like the efficacy of the Noah's Ark story. If someone is espousing beliefs that are actively harmful, i.e. promoting intolerance based on belief systems, expect me to be the first to stand up and say something. I can't allow this kind of thinking, and if I can help it, I will move to sway the believer into rethinking their position. But this will be done with reason and rational discourse, not with contradicting the finer points of the religious texts." Hmm. So I'm starting to think that he's moving into now saying, well, we shouldn't make arguments against religious texts or against dogmatic theism, but not against theistic beliefs.
Yeah, it's like this guy, I mean, as we read on, I think we'll find there's almost like two or three different thoughts he's having. Like, I didn't notice it at first exactly, but the title is why he's quitting the online atheism community, right? But here, like you say, it sounds like, okay, I'm done just arguing finer points of text. Because I wouldn't think that anything he's said thus far would be anything other than reason and rational discourse. So I guess he's admitting that he wasn't doing reason and rational discourse. I don't get it. Like, if that's what he's saying he's going to do now, what was he doing before, I guess?
Right. Well, there's also this idea that I've been thinking about lately. I don't think there's anything wrong with trying to discuss what's wrong with believing in the Noah's Ark story as an actual, you know, historical fact or an event as told by the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
There is a use in doing that, but there's also a time and a place to do it. And yeah. I think perhaps many, if not most, online communities, it's not really the best place to do that as in a discussion format. The information's already out there. If you want to know all of the contradictions in the Bible, it's not that hard to find that information. But it's too easy for people to become, and he kind of makes this point, it's too easy for people to become personally attacked when you discuss something like that, if it is someone who believes a story in a little literal way, that I think that discussion is best had face-to-face. Perhaps it's less effective to have that conversation online, but that's not the only way that one can be an activist atheist or take part in that.
Yeah.
So in that way, maybe he's not far wrong.
Yeah. You know, how about you keep reading here, because I just was looking ahead and now I think there's I could be wrong, but it seems like somewhat contradictory statement he makes later.
All right, sure. Keep going. So he says, "It all comes down to a simple fact, which I think applies to internet communities. So frequently home to us versus them thinking. In general, people will be more easily swayed if you don't attack them personally. Others in the atheist community might say that an attack on religion is not a personal attack, but to many believers it is, because that is what they base their lives upon. If you mock or criticize the believer's convictions, it is though you are attacking them personally, and they will shut down the conversation right there. Even worse, they'll go into all caps mode, as if that makes the defensive belief more substantial. An argument can be more convincing if it gives context and information instead of just derision. Discussing the mathematical or physical impossibilities of Noah's Ark is more likely to sway the believer than just saying, that's a fairy tale and you're a moron for believing it."
See, so now that sounds like he is talking about technicalities of biblical texts. Like, so, right? I mean, he says, okay, discussing these technicalities of religious texts is more effective. You know, it almost contradicts what he was just saying before. So now the more I read this thing, I had already read it two or three times, but I guess the fourth time was the key here, because I didn't notice how, I think it's maybe, I'm not trying to be too terribly critical of him, but I think it's maybe a little poorly written just on the organizational standpoint, just from an organizational standpoint. I think his thoughts are okay, but I think the way he organized this and the way he titled it starts you expecting one thing, and then it sort of morphs and he sort of changes what he's talking about. Because now, could you tell me what he means by quitting the online atheism community? I honestly couldn't really tell you. Because at first it sounded like, okay, he's not even going to engage anyone. And then it sounds like he's, okay, I'm just going to engage people with reason and rational discourse and not with contradicting the finer points of religious text. And then fast forward another couple paragraphs and it's, well, discussing the mathematical, physical impossibilities of Noah's Ark is much more likely to sway a believer than just saying that's a fairy tale. So yeah. I don't know what he means now. So I'll just, and I'm not trying to like bag on him or anything. I'm not a writer. I'm not trying to come from like a point of view that I'd be much better or anything, but in terms of the thoughts he's trying to express here, I guess if he's saying that you shouldn't be online finding people to say that's a fairy tale and you're a moron for believing it, then that's, yeah, I 100% agree with that.
That's spot on. Yeah. He's got that.
I don't think I've ever done that. I mean, I of course, sometimes, again, back when Facebook was interesting, I get in debates and sometimes it can feel a bit personal, but I don't think I've ever said I never do that. I mean, having said that, again, maybe in the wider online atheism community, I'm sure that happens. I mean, there is a big community of atheists online who seem to be very insensitive.
I think we're not just talking about atheists online. We're talking about
everyone,
the effects of anonymity.
Yeah.
Right.
True.
And so it's not the atheism that is making people act like assholes. It's the anonymity of the internet and the immaturity of the person doing it.
Yeah.
I think, you know, they don't care about what they're talking about or what they're doing. They're just trolling. They're just looking to get a rise out of people.
And
that's, you know, and that sucks and that happens. And some of them are atheists and some of them are willing to put their name on it and take responsibility for the stupid things that they say.
There are a million. I have no idea what the actual numbers are in terms of ratio, but I can tell you that there's no shortage of conservatives who will. I actually did a tweet one time on my Thomas in the Bible, which is also kind of my personal Twitter. I don't know. It's just I make jokes or sometimes I make atheism points, but more often I'm just trying to make jokes. But I made a joke about, what's the TV show guy, the stupid show I'll never watch? Duck Dynasty guy?
I know what you're talking about. I don't know the guy's name.
I don't care, but I kept seeing it everywhere. And, you know, Sarah Palin and the like kept talking about how it's freedom of speech or whatever. And so I tweeted, freedom of speech, in all caps. The right to say whatever you want and the TV network you're on is required to keep paying you money. And that's freedom of speech. And then I hashtagged, and this is the only reason I'm bringing this up. I'm not trying to toot my tweet horn, plug my Twitter. Although, if you want to follow me, it's at T and the B. Anyway, I did hashtag stand with Phil, and I never use hashtags. I was late onto Twitter, so I don't know that much about it. But I never use them, but I use that as an ironic hashtag, like hashtag stand with Phil, right? And I didn't know that I didn't know that hashtags actually did anything really. And I got like two or three people right away liked it and, or whatever you do, and like favorited it or retweeted it or something. And from their pictures that are in their little, you know, profiles or whatever, I could instantly tell that they didn't get the irony. So it was two or three conservative people who thought I was just standing with Phil. Like I don't know what they're doing. I don't know if they sit around and search like that hashtag and favorite tweets, you know? But, so that was kind of funny. And I think I even commented on that. But one guy just kept tweeting at me, like in that conversation. I don't know if it was at me or somebody else who had joined the argument. And he just kept tweeting this weird Obama crap, you know, like, well, Obama's going to, like over and over with no one responding to him. And, you know, I think the first time some other guy responded to him and then he kept going. And then like five tweets later, I'm still getting notifications that he's saying like, someone just tell me like, how is Obama, blah, blah, blah. Like some conservative crap about Obama. And I finally had to block him because I'm like, I'm sick of getting these notifications, this guy having a conversation with no one. you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's no shortage of people like that. And I do think that, you know, maybe I'm biased, but I do think that with an atheist who is like that, I could probably actually have a conversation, you know, as much as they could be annoying, but I'm sure I could have a conversation with them. With this guy, there, like, just the way he was tweeting, it was like there was not really anyone home. He was just like parroting. The sentences were barely coherent. And yeah. I don't even know how I would start to even talk to that person. So there's no shortage of it on either side is the long point I'm trying to make.
No, yeah, I think that's true. Another thing, I mean, I guess I don't know if this is exactly related, but so the last bit that I just read, he said, discussing the mathematical or physical impossibilities of Noah's Ark is much more likely to sway the believer. I think that's, it really depends on the believer.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you're talking to someone who is truly convinced that the Bible is the holy word of God, you know, then I think that that's not going to work. The mathematical or physical impossibilities isn't really what they're interested in. And so I guess what I keep coming back to and what I think about whenever I read an article like this, or really whenever I hear any criticism of atheism as being rude or offensive or anything like that, is so often it's the case that the atheist is taking the wrong tactic with the wrong person in the wrong venue.
Mm-hmm.
And certain things like that's a fairy tale and you're a moron for believing it is the wrong tactic all the time.
Yeah, I don't know.
Other things like right discussing tactic. The mathematical or physical impossibilities and something along those lines, there are certain religious people that's just not going to lead to a fruitful conversation. And if that's your approach, that's really on you.
Yeah.
But that's not the only approach. That's not the only way to address that person and to have a useful conversation with them. And I certainly don't think that those two ways are the only means by which you can be an activist atheist. If you really want to take part, I don't think that you're limited to those approaches.
Yeah, I agree. If you don't mind, that just reminded me of another anecdote. When I was in the beginning, when I was in this part of the Bible on my Bible podcast, I was looking into it because this was kind of the first time for me that I was really taking apart the Bible. So I understand how easy it gets after a while, but I still had a bit of enthusiasm, you know, toward the beginning. So when talking about Noah's Ark, I came across lots of sites trying to justify it, you know, and my favorite one was that it started off with like, okay, they didn't need every animal. They only needed all the kinds or whatever, you know, and that was the first argument. And then it said like, well, certain things could be kept efficiently in order to, you know, fit everything on the ark and so that everyone had food. You know, it had some other practical point, I forget. And then point number three was also, of course, since it's God, I mean, he could just bend some of the rules so that it was big enough for everyone to survive. You know, it's like, wait, why is that number three? If you're automatically skipping to God could bend the rules so that the Noah's Ark could work, then how about that's the only one you need. You don't need like five points about like the logistics of the Ark. I just found it funny that they started essentially the argument was they started with one or two like practical points of how this could be possible, you know, like, oh, well, they only had to do this and this, blah, blah, blah. And then number three was, plus God probably bent the rules a bit and made it, you know.
Yeah.
So like
the one said, and only one necessary argument there.
Exactly.
Point number three.
How about you just say, oh, God bent the rules, whatever, yeah.
All right.
So your point about how the mathematical impossibilities probably not going to convince anyone.
Yeah.
I think it's still, I just saw, I don't know if you'd call it a meme. It was a picture. What do you call things on the internet now? It's probably not a meme, but maybe it's a meme. I don't know. It was just a picture of Noah's Ark, with its kind of statistics of how many things it needed to keep. And then the other picture was the Titanic, you know, and it's far bigger but had enough provisions for a couple, you know, 2,000 people for like 3 months or something. And the Noah's Ark was supposed to hold millions of creatures for a year or whatever. And so it's kind of funny. That kind of thing I find funny. Again, I, like you say, who knows if a believer sees that, what's their reaction? I guess they'll just say God did it. You know, I don't know.
It depends on the believer. Yeah. I mean, and that's kind of what I keep returning to. It really, the kind of conversation that you should have, you have to at least make some attempt to understand where they're coming from. Otherwise, you may end up just talking about things that their response will simply be, yeah, God bends the rules. Well, that's not, you know, talking about the impossibilities of something is going to get you nowhere in that circumstance.
Right. You know, I will say, though, I just thought of this because I think there's two sides to that, because I agree with what you're saying, and I think that a lot of people need to remember how many sort of progressive religious people there are who will honestly just not even care about your arguments about the Old Testament. They almost just ignore them, you know? They won't even, you know, you can argue about Noah's Ark and they'll be like, yeah, whatever, I don't even think that happened, or, you know, it's all metaphorical ark, you know, all that.
Yeah, right.
But I think that, like you said, you're exactly right when you said you need to kind of know which tactic to use which time, because I don't think you should always approach it as though that's how people believe, because there very much is a big group of people who aren't progressive religious people. I mean, when you're talking to someone who does believe that the Old Testament is literal truth, which I've come across those people, I don't tend to engage too much, but I think it's important to realize you're talking to someone who believes a lot of horrible things are literally true. So I think it is appropriate to sort of try to challenge some of those things, you know, like, because if they believe the Old Testament is literally true, I mean, there's no shortage of just psychotic things that they're saying they believe. I again, not ridicule them, but if you say, like, well, how about this verse here? I think that could be useful. I mean, if you said, well, how about this one here where you're supposed to kill people who, you know, pick up sticks on Saturday, or this one that says, you know, if you eat shellfish, then you should be killed. You know, all this stuff. Like, how about that? You know?
Yeah, right. No, I think those are much, much more effective ways to approach that kind of a situation.
Yeah, I only say that because most of the time, the kind of criticism I come across, not about me, but like about atheists, is, oh, you're just arguing to the fundamentalists, who are such a small percentage. And I think that can be true. And definitely, if you're not talking to a fundamentalist, I don't think there's any point in looking to the Old Testament unless you're making a very good argument why they should pay attention to it. But you're not, that's not always the case. That's the only point I'm trying to make. If you are talking to a fundamentalist, I think there are things in the Old Testament you need to discuss.
Sure.
Okay. Sure. Sorry. That was a long,
Yeah, I'll go ahead and finish this piece up.
Yeah, it's almost
just
over.
A little bit left. So he says, atheists and non-believers make up such a small part of the world's population that we can never hope to change the world by ourselves. Certainly not if our primary weapon is yelling at people who don't agree with us. Most theists in the world are not completely delusional. Many see their faith as being primarily about an afterlife and dismiss the more ridiculous stories about the apocalypse, for instance, as parables used to illustrate a point. The problem is, the people we hear most from are not the rational ones. It's the fanatics and the largest and loudest voices. I've decided to define myself by what I stand for in life, rather than what I don't believe in. I call this methodological humanism. In essence, methodological humanism is a standpoint by which everyone, theist, agnostic, and atheist alike, can agree on as a platform from which we can all benefit. The need for food, water, and sanitation, the protection of our natural environment, and the preservation of the world as a whole. Without these things, we as a species cease to exist.
Oh, I think I might have to pause here. Sorry. Don't you see that paragraph is pretty problematic? I mean, how does he think that everyone, theist, agnostic, and atheist, can agree on his version of humanism? I don't really see how that's possible. I mean, I think that might be the problem with this sort of positive message, which I think is great. He wants to find common ground. I understand that. But I think you run into trouble when you're dealing with theists who will not agree with your view of humanism, you know, of how the world needs to work. You know, they don't agree that we need to save the planet because God will save the planet, or they don't agree that abortion should be legal because God says it should, you know, like that.
Yeah, no, that's certainly right. Or even something, when I read that, I was thinking of protection of our natural environment. That's a huge political issue now. That, I mean, New England is having one of the coldest winters, or recently had one of the coldest spells come through. And as soon as that happens, you see on the news, cold spell gives rise to doubt about global warming,
right?
You know, and this kind of thing. And it's, yeah, there, and a lot of that is just ignorance, but some of it may be religiously driven. And people certainly won't come together on what their idea of humanism is. I don't see anything wrong with trying to be a part of a community or a movement that does that, but I think the expectation that everyone, theist, agnostic, and atheist alike, will agree that...
Yeah, that's the part I had a problem with. I think it's just a little too idealistic to say that once you stop being, you know, once I say you as in him, like from his point of view, once he stops with these personal attacks that he's been doing online, that magically everyone's going to agree with his humanism because there's, you know, it's not necessarily atheism based. You know, I think that's a bit of a fantasy once you start talking about most of the Republican Party. So I don't.
Well, I think it is too, especially if something you want to talk about is human rights. And so you maybe discuss gay marriage and the right for homosexual couples to adopt children and raise children.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people that take issue with that on religious grounds. That very quickly becomes a religious discussion if their reasoning is religious reasoning.
Absolutely.
And that's not the only case that's like that. Abortion is like that. I think the whole idea that we must force people to stay alive in vegetative states.
Yeah, yeah.
Assisted suicide. There's this terrible case. I don't know if you've seen that, but there's this case of this poor girl who went in for a routine surgery.
Oh, that one. Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah. And she found out it turned out she had complications of the surgery and was declared brain dead. And her family did not want to pull the plug. They wanted to continue giving care, even though in the state of California, the insurance companies are under no obligation to provide care for a patient who is brain dead, and the hospitals don't have to do it. And so there was this big uproar over extending the care, and a judge finally did say that her care must be extended. And it's terrible. I'm not going to try to speak for the family and their reasoning and the grief, you know, the grief that they're going through is really something that I have no right to kind of speak about. But I do think many of the people supporting keeping this girl on life support when brain dead is dead. Unfortunately, it's as terrible as it is, you know, you're not coming back from being brain dead. And a lot of that is for religious reason.
Yeah.
And people really do suffer. Families suffer. Sometimes families are split on the issue and some family members really want to be able to say goodbye and let go. And they understand what it means to be brain dead. And other family members are, you know, maybe they have a harder time coping, and it could be, This division is so important for the family, and it could be a division over religious grounds. I think often it is.
Yeah, that's a whole can of worms that we probably could do another episode about, maybe. But
oh yeah, for sure.
I wonder, not to try to contradict you or anything, but I wonder how much of that is also just from movies and TV shows. You know, for crying out loud. I mean, Maybe the genesis of that is like the miracle. So in the end, it probably is religion based. But I wonder how many of the misconceptions about being brain dead are because in whatever movie, you know, the person pops out of it miraculously, you know, something like that. I wouldn't be surprised if that's a big part of it.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't thinking that people necessarily believe that a miracle will happen. But there is the movement that we don't have the right to end of life. Like we
don't
have
the right to
stop
spending
life going
vast resources on someone is really what it comes down to.
Yeah. Right.
When you put it in terms of, go ahead.
Oh no, I do think that this is something that we should discuss at length outside of this, but, I just imagine this is a clear case where there may be a religious divide there.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
and his sort of methodological humanism is not going to be effective in solving this problem, where you really do have to talk about sometimes the religious issues and that, you know.
Yeah, I think we will get more into this later with, I know, some of the books we're planning on reading and talking about. But this is sort of a foreshadowing of, there does seem to be a movement among atheists now, or maybe among atheists / religious apologists kind of, to stop focusing on why religion is wrong or bad and just focus on quote unquote common ground. You know, I think that's a big movement now. And just as a first brush, dealing with it, I think that this is the issue with it. Like we have said, I mean, I don't think that everyone's going to be in, finding the same common ground that you are. I just don't. But well, let's finish this thing up. Sorry.
Yeah, here's an interesting end to this. So he says, so much of internet discourse is based upon the disagreements we have with one another, and sometimes it feels like sport about scoring points and relishing your opponent's missteps. But if we can first find a space where we can agree, a bottom line for the well-being of all people, then the arguments about beliefs begin to look like petty squabbling over childhood toys. This is not to say that I think people should stop arguing, quite the opposite. Argument helps us suss out the finer points of what we believe to be our rights and needs, and what are simply comforts that we are so used to having that we can't imagine life without them. I get the sense that the disorganization of ideas here is pretty evident. I mean,
yeah, it really is. I mean, by the end, I don't really know fully what he's saying. There's one more paragraph where you want to just type. It's a short one. I figure we just tackle it and then.
Sure. It says, I'm not calling for a ceasefire altogether between atheists and believers online. In fact, I think that we still need those who will relentlessly chase down believers for their ludicrous ideas, especially when they cause harm in the world. But I will not be the one doing it. And those who are in the trenches should think harder about their own tactics.
All right. He is really middling, isn't he? I mean, he's even middling about his own article. Like, by the end, it's like, well, I'd not to say that anyone should join me in this. You know, like, what? I don't know. By the end, it seems to be pretty contradictory, this whole thing. But I guess if I'm going to try to give him the benefit of the doubt, which I am, you know, I think it's a good thing if he's encouraging people not to launch personal attacks on religious people, you know, online. I think that's definitely don't do that. Anyone. I don't think that's helpful. So I guess that's a positive message. On the other hand, like we were saying before, I mean, if you are someone like me who doesn't mind debate, as long as it's with someone who's, I don't even bother if it's with someone you can't even talk to, But you know, I'm always down for a conversation and argument, and I don't think of it as banging my head against the wall because I enjoy it. It's you know, trying to reason with someone, trying to find out how you can say something that maybe you'll get through to them. You know, I don't know. So if you're that way, continue doing it in a respectful way, I guess. So we had a couple of comments for our first episode that we wanted to talk about because we definitely want to encourage participation in the show. And also just know that any good comments you write publicly on our social media or on our website might be read at any time. So that's our little disclaimer there. So David, would you like to read the first comment?
Sure. So we have one comment posted by Quaz on Atheistically Speaking. This one says, nice first episode, man. As for Santa and kids, I think Tom got it right. It's wondering if a non-believer kid will upset some other believer, causing some sort of social melee. If the kid is old enough, I think the approach of getting them to understand others may believe things they don't can be a real growth moment for them. Though I'm not sure teaching kids to try to break said beliefs is a good idea. Getting them to understand that sometimes they have to hold their tongue is a good thing. As a summer day program counselor one year, I had a kid come up to me, just out of the blue. Did you know my mom and dad believe in Santa? I just asked, why do you think that? This tiny kid said, they like to make to believe for me, so it's okay if I pretend too. Some kids can be quite clever.
I don't think either of us, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think either of us said that we should train our kids to try to dispel the belief for others. That seems to be, he said, I don't think teaching kids to try to break said beliefs is a good idea in others. And I agree with that, but, and I don't think either of us said that, right? I mean,
Yeah, I hope we didn't say that. I certainly misspoke if I did.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
because I think it's non-productive. Kids don't really know enough to kind of go around doing that sort of thing. So I definitely agree with that. I like the social melee because that's kind of how I imagine kids would go at it.
Yeah, kids do everything in a melee. So it's either, whatever they're doing is probably a melee. I think the difference that you and I maybe had was in the level of aggressiveness in telling our kids there is no Santa. Like at first, and as I listened back to the episode, David, I wasn't sure. At first, it sounded like you were saying you were taking a more aggressive stance, like you'd actively tell your kid there was no Santa, or maybe that was me reading into that. And then toward the end, it sounded like you would just kind of not really talk about it or just be neutral about it. So I'm not sure. Do you want to clarify that at all?
Yeah. I mean, I think I would certainly be neutral about it. I mean, if my kid wanted to kind of believe in Santa, I would treat it the way that you would treat kind of any make-believe thing. I wouldn't encourage it. I wouldn't necessarily discourage it unless it got to a point, I suppose. I mean, if my kid asked me point blank, is Santa Claus real? You know, then I would be inclined to tell the truth.
Right.
Because I think Santa's a little bit different than a lot of the make-believe things that children are raised with and experience, different than some TV shows or that sort of thing. Because there is this, like we talked about in the first episode, in the big media, the push that Santa is real, you know?
Yeah.
And
well,
that
he's
might
in every goddamn commercial and he's in every, it's.
Yeah. So that might lead kids to ask questions and that sort of thing. If they want to know stories about Santa, I would treat it like it's sort of like folklore. It's a myth kind of thing, but it's fun. You know, it can be fun for kids, but I wouldn't talk about it like Santa Claus is a real thing.
Yeah, I just think it's going to, I think that you'll be a little more forced to take one side or the other once that, you know, there's a woman involved and presumably there's a mother involved who's going to be addressing
my kid on the street.
Yeah. Addressing, you know, presents from Santa and, you know, like there's lots of little things that go on and maybe you can just be this sort of neutral father, but between the two of you, I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if you had to commit more one way or the other once it actually happens, but I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I wouldn't balk at the idea of committing and kind of going the route of there is no Santa.
Okay. Yeah. I kind of agree, actually. It sounds like we're coming from the same place, actually. Although originally it sounded like it might be a little different. I think that that's probably where I am, too. So,
I guess, just for me, it depends on how the topic is brought up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the kid is straightforward saying, is Santa real? All my presents are from Santa. I would say straightforward, absolutely not. But if my kid's kind of not really interested in Santa Claus and kind of going with the flow, then, you know, if there's not a need to really talk about it, then...
All right, your kid comes up, this just came to mind. I mean, this is the kind of... Because I just spent Christmas with a bunch of tiny little shits, and your kid comes up to you Christmas morning. He goes, Dad, look what Santa brought me. What do you say? I'm just curious. What is your instinct?
Well, I wouldn't label the present Santa, so it'd
no,
be
but
weird
somebody
if they said.
Did. A relative did, or maybe your partner did, you know?
Yeah, I might be inclined to say, oh, you know, Santa was Auntie whatever this year, you know?
Oh, like actually have him come out with it. Okay. I might be,
I don't know. It's hard to say.
Yeah.
You know, but I wouldn't be against that.
Yeah. Just outing whoever it was.
Yeah.
No, it's Santa, like Santa, like Saint, you know, it's Santa, you know, Santa Rosa, the city of Santa Rosa. Just make something up. Okay. You want to go on to the next comment?
Yeah, sure. We also have a comment from Reno. This one was posted on our Facebook page. It says, I'd like to weigh in a little on the Santa idea you discussed on the podcast. It is closer to God than I think many people give it credit for. The real benefit of it over letting the children know that their parents have brought them their presents is that Santa is an omnipotent figure that can monitor the child's behavior even when the parents aren't there. I really doubt that children are actively thinking about whether Santa is watching them when they consider misbehaving, but that seems to be the thinking keeping parents from taking the credit. Also, though you alluded to the concept, another benefit of the myth on the atheistic side is that it might prime them to not believe anything even their parents confide in them and look at the logistics and evidence for it. Once again, it might not matter at all, as children probably naturally distrust their parents as they get older. and that millions of people who grew up with the myth are still less than skeptical about many things. But it is a fair skeptical exercise that would probably be more effective than simply reminding them that anyone can be wrong or lying to you. So it looks like there are two pieces here. There's the piece about Santa being an omnipotent figure, and maybe the motivation for parents to not take the credit of the presents is that it might improve the child's behavior. I see that as one bit here. And then the second bit is kind of maybe atheists ought to kind of go for this to prime disbelief. So I want to talk about the first one a little bit first.
Yeah, I'd like to just say quickly on that. Credit to Reno. We didn't point out that particular thing about Santa, about the omnipotence. You know, we didn't mention that. That's a good point. I guess that is a little more incentive for parents to be doing it than to let Santa do it. So I just wanted to say credit to Reno for that.
Yeah. I noticed too, we definitely did not cover that. I don't know. I don't think my parents did it because they thought I was behaving very well, but I never behaved. So maybe that's just kind of, I was a terrible kid. So
yeah,
maybe that's why.
It could be a good, I mean, when you're like with my brother, as an example, when you see people having to raise kids and it can just be so trying a lot of times, you know, if that's a tool they can use and it helps them, then I could understand why they do that. I don't think I would. I'd just say, you're not getting any presents. You know, I'm not going to give you any presents.
I do wonder if some people may use it as sort of like a lazy parenting technique. You know, the parents that will, oh, if you don't behave, you're not going to get this thing. You're not going to get this thing. And then their kid throws a fit and then they give them the cookie anyway. Or, you know,
right.
Whatever.
And the thing about kids is they just don't, this just doesn't work. Like they forget about it immediately, or they have no impulse control. So they never think like, wait a minute, and once they get old enough to have that impulse control, then they're probably past Santa anyway, I think, but
mm-hmm. Hopefully. I don't know. It is an interesting thought. I would be interested to know, like, to speak to other, you know, parents and ask them why they do it.
Yeah.
Cause in my experience, a lot of it is what we've talked about, where it's the magic of childhood. And if you,
now, are you talking about why any parent would do it, or why an atheist parent?
No. Why any parent in general might do it.
I think that first off, the first order of business is that a high percentage of people just do whatever. Like, they just do the thing. Like, whatever's the normal, they just go with the social norm, and they wouldn't even think about not, you know, giving their kid the Santa myth, because that's what they grew up with, and that's what everyone else grows up with. I think a lot of people are very just go with the herd mentality in most things. That's a disdainful opinion. I don't know, but that's how it seems to me. Because whenever I try to talk to people throughout my life, when I've had it appears that I have dissenting views a lot of times from the majority, especially being an atheist. Whenever I try to talk to people about anything, most of the time they just don't know what I'm talking about. They're like, they can't imagine a world where you wouldn't just go with Santa Claus. Like, they don't get it. They're like, why? I don't understand. You can't even communicate with them on that. So that's most parents, I think. But if we're talking about a sample that's sort of on the fence about it, or is more skeptical, that I don't know. That might be a different story.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't personally know any skeptical or atheist parents at this time in my life, so I don't really know what they. Well, I guess my sister is somewhat sort of doing like an interesting thing with the Santa Claus idea. But I don't know that she's really approaching it on this level. I'd be interested to know what she would say.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, we did allude to using the, as an atheist, using it as a lesson or whatever. And I mean, it may be some manner of preference that I can't fully articulate well, but I just don't think you need some lesson for that. You know, I mean, other than just real life, because you can just imagine a parallel world where there wasn't a Santa Claus myth and everything would be fine. And
yeah, it wouldn't even be a question. And I'm so against the idea of this structured, organized lie to your children that I couldn't do that. Especially to use it as a tool makes it even worse. It makes it a manipulative lie. That just, to me, kind of rubs me the wrong way. But I do see the point. You know, maybe some people would think that would be effective.
Yeah, I don't like it, though. It's manipulative. I don't like it. I think that I think kids learn a lot through example more than anything, and just emulation, you know. So I think the first step is just to be skeptical in your everyday life and to be someone who cares about evidence, to look things up, you know, when you don't know something, that's going to, I feel like that's going to drastically change newer generations. You know, back when we were little, or at least I was, you're a couple of years older than you, but not that much. You didn't have this amazing resource to just look up anything at any time. Like, your parents would tell you stuff and they'd be like, yeah, I think, that, you know, old wives' tales are going to have a lot harder time existing now. I think because kids just, you know, if your mom tells you like, yeah, if you, you know, it's like some wart remedy or something that's just nuts that has nothing to do with anything, they're just going to Google it and be like, oh, this doesn't do anything. More so than before.
I think some of them, I mean, a lot of that kind of the existence of old wives' tales and confirmation bias still exists online.
Yeah, of course.
And people post these stupid ideas online and then some idiot looks it up and goes, oh, you know, you spun around in a circle three times and jumped up and down and it solved your hiccups, you know?
Yeah, I think that it, of course, it's always going to exist. And to use the example I brought up earlier, or in episode two, I don't remember which episode it was, but you know, 9/11, of course. And even in this day and age, people are 100% capable of being completely misinformed about a lot of things. But relative to each individual era, like pre-internet and after internet, you have to say that post-internet or during internet, intra-internet, there's going to be a higher force of people being able to get this information at any time.
Yeah, there are many more tools for a skeptical mind.
Yeah.
I think that's definitely true.
Or maybe the marginal people, you know, someone who's close in one circumstance wouldn't have been able to look it up and just kind of buys into it. Whereas with this gadget in their hand that they can just look something up with, you know, that pushes them down the path of, oh, wait, just not everything people says, you know, people say is true, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Different in a marginal case. But anyway, I guess we should wrap this up.
All right.
Unless you had anything else to add.
No, I don't think so. That's great. Thank you for the comments. We really appreciate them.
Although apparently if we're going to take this long for two comments, then never mind. Don't give us any. We'll accept two. No, we'll probably, if we get a lot of comments, we'll obviously just read whatever, that, you know, the best one or two. And maybe it won't, you know, we won't take this long on it, but it was a good conversation and glad we got it going. So thank you guys. And I think we need to wrap this episode up actually right now. So thank you for listening to episode 3. And I will say from me and David, see you next episode. Join us for episode 4 on Thursday when we will finally be discussing whether or not atheism is for the privileged.